This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Time now for a look back at the week's news. We're joined by NPR senior news analyst Dan Shore. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Scott.
And, of course, let's begin with the oil spill. But going on for 7 weeks now. But the estimate of just how much oil is leaking out of the well keeps changing. As an experienced reporter, what does this indicate to you?
Well, it indicates that if somebody has an interest in having that number high and someone has an interest in having that number low, clearly the BP oil company has it in its interest to try to keep it lower. They started out with saying maybe 5,000 barrels a day. Now that's come up to maybe 40,000 barrels a day, because when you look at the size of it, you decide where the money has to come from, and BP is aware that a large, large chunk of it will come from BP.
Are there some technical considerations too? Certain technologies they can apply if the spill is this much, but not that much?
Yes, but all the technologies are in the hand of BP. That's the other part of it. The government puts a lot of pressure on BP, but can't really take care of this thing by itself, because all the various tools and things to do this are all in the hands of BP.
Let me ask you about primary elections this week. And it's being acclaimed as the week of the woman in politics.
Yes. And in a sense, it was. There were half a dozen or more women who won nomination either to the Senate or as governor in all of this. And I don't think that we've ever had quite that number before. You take that along with a certain amount of Tea Party support, and you find there are new currents that are entering into American politics, and we're getting different kinds of coalitions than we've had before.
Something I noticed, you had the two women who were nominated as senator and governor in California.
California, yes.
Are wealthy corporate figures.
And that's the other side of it, yes. There is a lot of money involved in this, and when women have money, they can play politics as men do.
A conference committee made up of members of the House and Senate sat down this week to try and work out differences between the two versions of the financial regulation bill. What do you detect in the negotiations so far?
Well, it's in conference, and that conference is going to last for several weeks, apparently. But it looks as though it's moving towards passage of some kind of bill which will provide financial regulation. There are lobbyists who are still fighting it, but it does look now as though there will be a bill.
General Stanley McChrystal said this week that the long anticipated offensive in Kandahar and Afghanistan would be delayed. What do you make of what do you see as being behind this?
That's easy. This war is not going very well. They wanted to go into Kandahar and first tell all the people that they would support them, but the people apparently not listening to them. And so General McChrystal is having to postpone the offensive that he's been talking about for all these many, many months. Now he's talking about come next December or so, they will have to have another look at what the situation is. It is very, very perilous, and nobody's claiming today that there's a victory being won.
And this could affect the administration's timetable, which they had declared a few months ago for withdrawal?
Well, that's right. They talked about starting next summer of next year, they would start withdrawing troops. Now there is a lot of pressure on saying, if you start talking about withdrawing troops, you're giving it up. And a lot of pressure on them to keep the troops there, perhaps even to send more. It is very, very, very difficult to withdraw troops who are losing.
UN Security Council backed a new round of sanctions against Iran this week. Any confidence that new sanctions are going to change Iran's nuclear program?
Well, these sanctions are not very drastic, as a matter of fact. And Iran seems not to be bothered by it at all. And even though Russia and China voted for it, and they voted for it apparently also because there wasn't too much in it, I mean, one has to say that Iran is winning this round. They have not changed their nuclear program. They give no sign of changing their nuclear program. And whatever the sanctions are seem not to bother them very much.
Israel slightly eased some items in its blockade of Gaza this week, following last week's uproar about the Israeli raid on an aid flotilla that killed nine activists. Israel said they'll now permit in certain snack food items and spices. Is this just a gesture or something more?
Oh, it is a gesture, and it could be something more if Hamas were willing to accept it. But Hamas is not willing to accept it. They will not say, you can give us snack food, but you can't give us that. They want to see the blockade lifted, and right now they're holding out for it.
Hmm. Finally, Dan, Steven Strasburg.
Yes.
I believe he's 21 years old, 14 strikeouts.
Yes.
In his debut with the Washington Nationals. An amazing first game. I believe this is the first time you've ever asked to talk about a sporting event.
Did I say I want to? I just want to say that I think it's quite a remarkable thing that this young man can throw a ball so fast that nobody can hit the ball. I mean,
well, some guy did get a home run off it. Well, you know what batters say: the faster it comes in, the faster it goes out.
Yeah, when it goes out, but
when they catch up with it, right?
But I've been very impressed with the way this man throws a ball. It's very, very fast.
Yes, it's a major league pitcher, Dan.
And how,
Mr. Baseball, Dan Shore?
Yes, sir.
You're hearing one of the many action sequences from the new film Prince of Persia. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal, who plays a peasant-turned-royal warrior in 6th-century Persia. He carries a magic dagger that can turn back time. Arrows fly, swords swing, but dialogue? Well, that's not this film's strong suit. Prince of Persia is the latest in a string of recent movies reviving the old sword and sandals formula that was popular back in the 1950s and 60s, pictures like Ben-Hur and Cleopatra. But is that formula successful today? Well, if there's one person who has the answer, it's Bob Mondello, our film critic. Bob, hi.
Good to see you.
And I'm happy to see that for this occasion you are in full Roman battle gear.
These are my people, after all, the Romans.
So, what qualifies as a sword and sandals picture?
Well, there were two kinds of them. One was the ones you just mentioned, which were things like Ben-Hur and The Robe and Greatest Story Ever Told. And the other was the kind of cheapy that was made in Italy back then, the Hercules movies and the Samson movies and the big splashy things. And they always had some kind of a weightlifter in the lead rather than an actor. They were dubbed. They had belly dancing. You had to have a lot of belly dancing. And some kind of legendary creature, which would probably threaten the lead at some point. Huh. They had titles like The Fury of Achilles or Kindar the Invulnerable or something like that. You know, they would just make things up.
Am I crazy in thinking that there has been a flurry of these kinds of films recently, like this year?
Yeah, there have. You're absolutely right. Let me think. There was that Clash of the Titans. There was Percy Jackson and the Olympians.
Right.
I think that's a high school student who discovers that his father is actually Poseidon.
You know, that happened to me recently.
Exactly. Yeah. Mine's Apollo. There have been those and this new one, The Prince of Persia, and you want to throw in Sex and the City, too?
Yeah,
they
right.
They went to
right.
Abu Dhabi, after
right,
all.
Of course, yes.
So there's a lot of things that are set in that part of the world.
And I've got to say, Bob, I have seen some of those films that you mentioned, mm-hmm. and how do I put this? None of them are Ben-Hur or
yeah, that's putting it mildly.
Right.
Most of these are not very good movies. They are, however, popular, and they play well overseas. The logic being that you don't actually have to understand a whole lot of English to be able to get the dialogue.
There's dialogue in there's English?
Of course.
Now, we were talking before, as we often do before we have these conversations. Mm-hmm. There is one film that you liked.
Well, there's a picture called Agora, and this one is a little different from these others. It is set in Alexandria in Egypt. It is 390 AD, roughly, and the Romans are in charge, and they're annoyed at the Christians, who are getting uppity.
The Christians have gathered in the Agora. They are mocking the gods. We must put an end to these insults. They may not fear him, but they will fear our swords.
He was talking about Zeus when he said him.
Yes.
And this turns out to be a very bad idea, that they go after the Christians. The Christians then take over. And the Christians are meanies back then.
And this is actually one of the films that you think was pretty good, right?
Well, it's better than the others because it's a kind of a wonderful dissertation on fundamentalism. Mm. Because the Christians who come in have some very specific ideas about the way people should be reacting to their God. And they don't want to hear anything from anybody else. And the Jews have some very interesting notions about this, too. And so these three religions are crashing up against each other, the pagans and the Jews and the Christians. And there is this one scientist among all of them, and her name is Hypatia. And she is sort of aloof from all of this. She's working with astronomy and stuff and trying to figure out why the Earth doesn't seem to be the center of things, which is all
these
religions.
And this is played by Rachel Weisz.
Right.
As far as I am aware, your God has not yet proved himself to be more just or more merciful than his predecessors.
Lady!
Is it really just a question of time before I accept your faith?
Why then should this assembly accept the counsel of someone who admittedly believes in absolutely nothing?
I believe in philosophy.
Is it worth spending $9 at the movie theater to see it?
Well, I thought it was kind of interesting. I know you didn't. Yes, right.
I'm bearing the lead here.
You are.
Yeah, I just thought that the Hypatia character was implausible. You know, at the end when everything's crumbling down, she'll still have philosophy.
Yes. There's some things there that are kind of hard to swallow, including the fact that she gets to Copernicus's theories, I don't know how many years before he did. But it's an interesting debate to be having, the science versus religion thing. You can make a case that that is sort of like doing Ben-Hur or doing The Robe or something like that, that we're talking about religion in a grander sense.
That's NPR's film critic, Bob Mondello. Bob, thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. In summer, some people like a light, fun summer novel. Others like to read about the world being overtaken by bloodthirsty vampires who savage the planet and threaten to extinguish the whole of civilization. Hey, surf's up! The biggest book of summer so far is Justin Cronin's The Passage, a massive novel in which a band of people attempt to survive in a small colony surrounded on all sides by vampires. But these are not the sexy, debonair vampires of TV and Twilight. Justin Cronin's vampires are real monsters. Justin Cronin joins us now to talk about this book. It was released this week by Ballantine Books. He joins us from member station WHAD in Milwaukee, where he's on tour. Mr. Cronin, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let me ask you about the premise. A government experiment goes amiss. Mass death and destruction ensue.
Catastrophe, yes.
Yeah, and 90 years later, I believe, there are a colony of survivors living in California. An important part of the novel is the way human characters, may I say human characters?
Yes, you may.
And a few people in particular react to disaster. Tell us why that was important to you.
I decided that I would go about writing this book the way I wrote all my other books. The difference here was one of scale and I suppose also urgency. All novels come down essentially to moments in which characters make choices that they can't unchoose, where things change that can't be changed back. You can do this with an awkward dinner party, or you can do it by strapping your characters essentially to a runaway train of a plot, which is what I decided I was going to do. Mm-hmm. Plot is different from story. Plot is something you can describe in the abstract. It's a series of events. Every book's got one. But story is where plot and character meet. That's where they combine. And I'd learned to be a writer by writing about people, by writing about characters. And just because I had this very large canvas, a very energetic plot, I wasn't going to go about it differently in any way. I've never met even a secondary character that I didn't want to spend time with and figure them out. For the duration in which I'm writing them, they feel like the main character to me. And the way I go about this is I always make sure that I know every character's secret, what they're not telling anybody. And once I do that, their humanity just kind of ignites. But the range of characters in this book is, you know, much broader than anything I'd attempted before. And each time I went into a new character, you know, a homeless man in Houston, Texas, who ends up on death row, an FBI agent, a sort of mystical nun from Sierra Leone. I mean, this is the kind of range that I had in this book. And it was a lot of work and required a lot of concentration, but it was also really a lot of fun to do it. I got to have this whole vast cast of imaginary friends for the duration of writing the book.
Mm. Do you still have them with you?
Yes, I do. And the good news is that I get to use them again because I'm writing two more books in the world of these characters. And that means that I'm going to be living with and making these people really probably for another 5 years. It's sort of the great it's become the great project of my life. I don't think anything else will ever even quite come close.
We want to mention the two previous books that you've written. Marion O'Neill, you won the Penn Hemingway Award for that, and the Stephen Crane Prize, and a book called The Summer Guest. How does somebody who was known as a writer of literary fiction and smaller books go to writing something like this?
I think in some ways it's very much part of a continuum of my other work. But in the fall of 2005, my daughter came to me and suggested that I should write my next book about a girl who saves the world and that it should be interesting. I think she was concerned that my other books were perhaps a little boring.
how old was your daughter then?
She was 8 years old, just about 9 years old. So we're talking about a third grader, but my daughter is just she's a great reader, a great consumer of story. She reads while walking, while brushing her teeth. We've actually had to make rules about not reading at the dinner table. I've actually seen her bring a book onto a roller coaster for the dull parts.
that dull 10 seconds when it's just approaching the top.
Exactly, yeah. So when she came to me with the suggestion, I could only take it fairly seriously. And I said, well, all right, but you have to help me. And so for the next 3 months, every day when she was done with school, when I would take I tend to end my work day by going jogging. She would come along on her bicycle and we would play Let's Plan a Novel together. It was a version of a creative writing exercise, really, that I had done for many years with my students at Rice and before that at LaSalle University in Philadelphia. But those were college students. I was doing it with a 9-year-old. But somewhere along the way, it began to feel like I was really working on a book. And I decided that I would write a first chapter just to kind of see how it felt. And I never looked back.
We should know your daughter's name.
Oh, her name is Iris.
Iris. By the way, we're talking with Justin Cronin, who's author of the big new book, The Passage. Big in all ways, I should say.
Yeah, don't drop it on your foot.
May I ask, do you and your daughter have this all plotted out? Or?
I do, and I've had it plotted out from the start. I'm one of those writers who really is pretty systematic. I try to plan out as much in advance as I can. I feel like the day you start to write the book is like the day you launch a missile. You better have it aimed pretty carefully or you'll kill all your friends in England. So I try to make sure that I've targeted things as carefully as possible. When I realized this was going to be not just one book but three, I really had to know not just what the final moment of book three was, but actually what the last sentence was. It's always been my psychological habit or perhaps even a crutch, that once I know the last sentence of something, then I feel like it's writable. So I had to know that before I started, and indeed I did. I knew the final moment of all three books before I started writing the first.
Tell us about the role of children then, about the sanctuary in the story.
Yeah, children are really central to the book, and it was part of my original idea for the story that it was really a book in some ways about what we owe to our children. The vampire narrative is a narrative of immortality. The temptation of immortality is one that essentially the human race takes up in my book. I mean, a group of scientists decide let's tap into the biological ability to be immortal. This is a kind of deep greed that they commit. Because they fail to notice that we are already immortal because the future we do not personally live to see is the one our children live in. Mm-hmm. The sanctuary is a protected enclave within this colony of survivors. It sits at the center. It's an old elementary school. It's fortified. It is a last retreat in the event that the colony is invaded. And all the children in the colony live there until the age of 8, and they live in a bubble of not knowing. The world in which they live is one that is so potentially psychologically traumatic that the founders of this society have decided, well, we'll give people 8 years not to know the truth. And so the children live there sort of sealed away, not just from other people, but from the knowledge of what the world really is. And one person who's called teacher it's her job when you turn 8 to tell you what the truth is so that you don't hate your parents for it, actually. So she bears the collective trauma of this resentment.
You know what I think will strike any parent reading that?
Tell me.
That's what we want for our children anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's interesting that I chose 8 because I didn't realize, you know, I didn't quite realize what I was doing at the time, but that's how old my daughter was when we had this conversation. I mean, the book is full of all kinds of symmetries that have to do with my life as a parent. And, you know, at its heart, the passage is really a story about a father and a daughter. And that makes perfect sense because it was the father and a daughter who dreamed the whole thing up to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Cronin, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And have a wonderful summer, you and your daughter.
Thank you. I'm sure we will.
Justin Cronin, he is a professor of English at Rice University. Moreover, the author of The Passage, released this week by Ballantine Books and already skyrocketing up the bestseller list. He joined us from WHAD in Milwaukee. He's author of the previous novels, The Summer Guest and Marion O'Neill. Las Vegas never sleeps. At midnight, you can gamble, you can see a show, you can have a 70-course buffet, or you can take a biology class. This past term, the 2-year College of Southern Nevada joined some other schools around the country in offering midnight classes. Mary Bennett taught biology 189 in the wee hours. She joins us now from member station KNPR in Las Vegas. Professor Bennett, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Your class went on until 1:20 in the morning, I'm told?
The lecture went till 1:20 and the lab went to 2.
I mean, usually you pull an all-nighter studying, not going to class.
My class was very good, though. I had really a great group of students. They were very attentive. They did quite well for that time of day or night.
Why the need for midnight classes?
For the most part, the students at this type of classroom time slot works best for are some of our non-traditional students, mm-hmm. where both parents are working and they can't afford childcare. So we have the one parent working during the day while the one is watching the child, the other one working the early evening shift, the other one watches, and then this time slot works really well for them. It also works well for a lot of our casino employees who work a second shift situation and want to continue their education and do something else later on.
Do you have to have any kind of special educational approach at midnight and 1 in the morning?
Well, for myself, I didn't have to do anything different. I'm a very interactive teacher, so I think that's an important concept when looking for somebody to teach a midnight class, per se. So I actively engage the class. I'm constantly asking them questions, talking to them to keep them attentive.
Do students sometimes get a little droopy-eyed with all due regard to your teaching technique?
I didn't see it so much. I mean, this was the first time I taught a class this late. They were pretty good. I've actually seen students being more droopy-eyed in an 8 o'clock in the morning class.
How many students in your class, Professor?
Well, this first time we offered it, we only had like a one-section offering, so there was 24 students. In the fall, it will be a full course offering with, I believe, 44 to 48 students.
But it's very nice that in a community that has this nonstop schedule, as Las Vegas does, to be able to provide people an opportunity to extend their education that conforms to their requirements.
It really is. I mean, I think it's a great benefit for an area like this to offer that availability for a student to go to the next level. And that was a great experience. The lab students were really a lot of fun. And we stayed, you know, till the bitter end, 2 in the morning every time.
Thanks very much for speaking with us, Biology Professor Mary Bennett.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.